everyone, and welcome back. This is Glum Puddle, and today we have Jim Fan. Hi, Jim Fan. How you doing?
I'm doing okay, thanks.
Okay, folks, I'm sorry. That was my impression of Glum Puddle, since he butchered me.
That was really bad.
A few episodes ago. Well, the thing is, it's easy to do some people like, you know, Mr. Jimmy Stewart. You know, Jimmy Stewart has a very unique voice. But when you try to do someone like Glum Puddle, who just sounds like someone off the street, if he sounded like Puddle Glum, maybe I could do him. But anyway, no, I am back, hopefully for a long while, and we are here to continue our analysis of Voyage of the Dawn Treader. And we're going to pick up, Jim Fan and I, where Ransom and Glum Puddle left off last time. They basically left off with Eustace had just been turned into a dragon, and he picks up Edmund and shows him, I am Eustace, and then they're discussing with Caspian and Lucy, and you know, Caspian says, well, everyone knows that dragon treasure is enchanted. So we basically have a campfire scene where they decide to kind of stay on the island and think about it that night. And it's kind of, I got the impression, this was just, I'm just remembering back, I think this is one of the first kind of breather moments you have in the movie.
It's getting there. I mean, when you count the, the Lucy, when she's in the magician's house, it's not very, that's slower paced.
Yeah, it was, was well paced. It wasn't a breather moment, but it was definitely a more thoughtful portion of the film where they put a lot of thought into it. But,
this is where Lucy and Gale are talking, right?
Yes.
Is this, okay.
Yeah.
You can tell it's been a while. I knew I should have gone to see the movie last week.
Yeah, the film is out of the area where I am, so I can't really find it and see it. And no one has done a fan script, so if anyone knows of a fan script, go ahead and email me, reallian@narniweb.com. But, yeah, what did you, I mean, did you have any lasting impressions from the Gale dialogue scene?
Nothing negative, for sure. It seemed a little random, maybe, when you have this whole story going on and then suddenly we go back to the, Lucy and Gale, Gale has been largely insignificant to the story, even though she kind of popped up on the ship.
And why is she on the shore even, you know?
Right, and then it's supposed to be this, emotional conversation moment, you know, heart to heart, and it's just kind of you're like, oh, okay, now it's time, we're having a heart-to-heart conversation, and then next second, we're going back to fighting battles. It seemed rather a little bit shoehorned.
Mm-hmm. I would say forced. It just seemed like some forced character development. And if I could kind of contrast it or compare it to just even the scene where Lucy and Susan are...
I was just going to say.
Yeah, when they're in Narnia in the second film, just, you know, lying there, just talking... They came across, it was just, there seemed kind of like a natural conversation. Oh, yeah, they're sisters, they would just have this conversation. It seemed kind of natural, didn't seem that out of place.
And because we both know the characters, and we both know their, how they think. Whereas Gale, she's not really, we don't really know anything about her other than her father's on the ship and her mother's been eaten by the mist.
I mean, the whole point of Gale, which I'm not, as far as all the changes in the film, I'm not hugely opposed to this, except for the fact that I think it was a lot of the ideas I wouldn't have wanted to succeed even if they had been executed well. This one, maybe it could have been executed well. I think it would have still felt a little odd, but we're going to have another little girl to add that kind of human element, here's our kind of face of pity. I think it just kind of, she feels kind of awkward and out of place. It's like she doesn't belong. Yeah. She doesn't seem like an authentic character of Narnia. Or the Narnian universe, I should say, since they're not in Narnia. Anyway.
A lot of my complaint, my biggest complaint, I guess, with Dawn Treader, and this has to do with Gale, too, is that the things that they added, they didn't seem like they had a lot of time spent to really flesh them out and to make them feel part of the world. So while they were not, some of them were not necessarily bad ideas, they were just not handled very well.
Yeah. What did you think of... What did you think of how they built up... I'll just start off with my thoughts on... This is kind of moving to Reepicheep and Eustace.
Yeah.
Because this is the first portion of the film where they... You could arguably say that the first scene where they actually build a relationship is when, during the little fight scene.
Yeah.
But this scene is where you actually have more of a... it's kind of this, you know, next step in the relationship where they actually start to forge a bond, which at first I was very glad to see in the film because they do have a bond in the book, even though it's very subtle, and it's not a major point of they were enemies, now they're friends. It's not that obvious. It's just kind of this quiet mutual respect in the book. And an encouragement from Reepicheep. Here, I think there's so many little things that I think make it loses some of its power. For one thing, I think Eustace is portrayed a little more as a victim in the book by being a dragon, as opposed to in the movie. Whereas in the book, it's more like it's his own
just
doing.
Punishment.
Yeah, yes. Because in the movie, you know, he kind of stumbles upon treasure. And boom, next thing we see, he's a dragon. Whereas in the book, it's very pointed about how he intentionally left everyone while they were working because he was lazy. He wanted to go get some time to himself. He was had these greedy, dragonish thoughts. It was a little more, I think, and here's the revelation. This is how ugly he is on the inside. It's kind of like, you know, now his outside is as ugly as his inside. And it seemed like more of a pitiable... It seems like Reepicheep reaching out to Eustace at this time was, in the book, even more gracious, where I think some of that is lost here.
I have to say, I do agree that some of Eustace's not character, but his the way he goes about things was changed a bit in the movie, where, like you said, the situation wasn't the same. Where in the book he was going off because he just wanted to shirk out of work and he was being selfish, and you get this whole running dialogue in his head about how he's found out school, he's going to take it home, and no one's going to tell him what to do again. Something along that lines. Whereas in the movie, he just kind of wanders off and stumbles on all this treasure, and he, like most people, kind of geeks out a bit. Until you get to the skeleton part, that is. That's pretty bad.
Yeah.
So when you have these changes, which you can say, okay, well, that wasn't necessary to change. But since they were changed, naturally it would make the reactions of everyone else a bit different. You know, the reaction of the audience different. Whereas, you know, in the book, this was something he was clearly doing, something he knew he wasn't supposed to be doing. Whereas in the movie, he kind of stumbled it on accident a bit, you know, and obviously he took action to... he could have not done that, but it's more of a...
Oh, but if everyone knows dragon treasure is enchanted, it's that kind of thing in the movie.
Right.
I think that, and also I think, and this kind of gets into some of the changes with Reepicheep's character. Reepicheep, it's so subtle, and it's hard for me to put my finger down on it. I think a lot of it has to do with why Reepicheep is on the voyage, whereas here it's sort of like, I always wanted to see Aslan's country, and we have nothing if not belief that it's there. And whereas in the book, it's his life's passion and longing. It's not just something he can't get out of his head. It's something that has filled him with his heart's desire. And I think that that's a completely side issue, but I think that gives Reepicheep more depth, and therefore I think it gives his relationships he has with people more depth. And even though in the film his relationship with Eustace has a lot more activity, a lot more dialogue than the book relationship does. I felt like, and I'm not asking whether you liked it or not, but I felt in the book like their relationship and the trust they had in one another was deeper and more substantive than what I felt in the movie.
I don't necessarily agree with that. I think the relationship between Eustace and Ribéry was probably one of my favorite parts of the movie. Just that was something I was really not expecting at all. And then to see it kind of happen in not a very heavy-handed way, it was really nice, and it was something I enjoyed seeing what was in the book being fleshed out a bit more, I guess. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I guess, I don't know, and this gets to how I think Reap loses a lot of dignity in Don Treader, where he seems to come across as kind of an adrenaline junkie.
Do you think he had more dignity in Prince Caspian?
Oh, yes.
Oh. See, I don't understand that at all.
Well, for one thing, okay, how many lines about chivalry does he have in Voyage of the Dawn Treader?
I can't quote you any.
I mean,
it's been a while.
Just think about it. We don't have to just dwell on this right now. We'll move on. But in, you know, why is he, you know, why does he fight? Why does he fight the way he does? Why does he? You don't have Reepy Cheep in the books is not just we just need to fight. I mean, he says, "Don't fight, push." When they're fighting the sea serpent, I mean, he actually thinks about these things. He's not doing it just for the sheer pleasure of it, and it's a lot deeper. Whereas in the film, you don't get that. So I think.
Well, see, I think that. Just because maybe he doesn't say chivalry, I think that
I'm not talking about the word chivalry.
Being an honorable and chivalrous mouse is more to do with your actions and your demeanor.
Can you give me an example in Don Treader?
I don't know
of an action of his that came across as extremely chivalrous and honorable, that it was done for the sake of chivalry and honor.
Well, you'd have to give me a Webster's definition on that.
Pick your own. I mean, I'm just asking you.
I don't want to, like, split hairs and pick out, you know, like, this is a perfect example or whatever, but just comparing the two characters, Prince Caspian and Reba Cheap seemed... to me...
Well, I'm not even talking about Prince Caspian. I'm talking about just Don Treader.
But you're just... thing we started on was we were comparing the two, and how I think that in Don Treader, compared to Prince Caspian, Reba Cheap is much more mature? That's one word, I guess.
No, I'm not talking about compared to the two. I didn't start off comparing them. I started off comparing him to the book. So can you just give me, because I'm just saying that it's just little things like that that I think takes away from the substance in their relationships.
I don't think so. I don't see how you could take the relationship between Reep, Cheep, and Eustace and say that that demeans, that lessens his character or his true personality.
Mm-hmm. What did you think of the line, "Extraordinary things happen to extraordinary people"?
That was a slightly Hollywoodish line. But to me, he was encouraging Reba Cheap, encouraging Eustace. Okay, go on. Say what you're gonna say.
Yeah, I was gonna say. Yeah, it seemed cliche, but also, it doesn't. It's like saying, well, it's okay. You're not actually this bad person. You're this really extraordinary person, and you just don't know it. As opposed to, you know, Reepy Cheep didn't have to say, "You've been a really rotten person." Eustace realized he'd been a really rotten person and he had to change. I mean, I think it goes to the heart of how bad a person is Eustace, and does he have to change? Or is the dragonishness this new problem? Is it just an enchantment and nothing more? You see, I think in the book it goes a lot deeper than in the film.
Right. Yeah, you might have a point there, and obviously I need to watch. It's been a while since I've seen the film, so I need to watch it again and collect my thoughts again, and then we can have a discussion again in a month or two.
Yeah, you can watch it again, and if you see a moment in the film where you think that Reepy Cheep comes across in that moment as really honorable and chivalrous, then you can point it out to me. Okay, moving on. Okay, the next part, Dragon pulling the ship. What was your reaction? Do you remember?
Like I said, I don't tend to have a running commentary in my head as I watch films.
I don't have to have a running commentary in my head. I just definitely do have reactions when I see certain lines. Sometimes I slap my head or, you know, go, what?
Cry. Yeah. It's definitely a somewhat creative idea, but I don't know if it really makes sense. I mean, props for them for thinking a little outside the box, I guess. But I probably could have done without that, since it's not realistic in the slightest.
Yeah, that's the thing, is in the... And this is gets... Okay, it... I will say this. I think in the movie it kind of worked. But in movies, you don't tend to think through things so much. Whereas in the book, Lewis was actually a pretty realistic thinking person as he wrote the book.
You know,
it was things like, when they go across... here's some examples. They reach the Lone Islands, and Caspian and the rest decide to walk across. And, of course, you have that little Lewis commentary. This was actually a very foolish thing to do, but Caspian didn't realize that at that point, you know? Because, I guess it would be kind of foolish, you know? And then you have things like, let's not sleep on the shore tonight because there's no point and it's almost dark, so let's just sleep on the ship and then go on to the land the next day. And then you have this whole discussion of, let's be realistic here. How would we feed Eustace as a dragon? Would he keep flying?
They don't even think about that in the movie, whereas it's something that's quite a significant portion of Eustace being a dragon.
Yeah.
You know, there's this whole agonizing, what are we going to do with him in this, this really... affects Eustace.
And I understand that they were trying to convey Eustace being... selfless. So, he's going to actually help out now. But I understand them changing
the
pacing.
Sort of like in the book when he helped around the island and he was picking out timber and helping
out
with two maps.
But here's what they missed. They got... I would say on just the principle of Eustace has turned over a new leaf and is willing to work hard to help the crew, both are accomplished, I would say, probably equally well. Yes, one is a little more is definitely more realistic. But the other one, I think, as far as just the image you get, Eustace going off to find a large piece of timber for the new mast, Eustace pulling the ship, both are accomplished. But in the book, you have this really, I thought, kind of just a really sad moment where Eustace kind of does the first selfless thing he's ever done, and he leaves them hoping that they'll actually leave without him. You know, remember he flies away so that he won't be found once he realizes what the problem he causes. And that, for me, reading that was always such a sad image to me, and it really built up, he's definitely turning over a new leaf here. And you lose that. And, it doesn't really have a whole... I'm just talking about the little things that they changed in the structure of the events.
Right.
There's a lot they lost that maybe they just didn't even think about,
Right. That definitely would have been... I think that would have been pretty powerful to see. And it would have conveyed so much in just one simple gesture.
Mm-hmm.
And I definitely miss seeing that.
Yeah.
So, it's unfortunate. There's lots of little bits... they got a lot of bits that they did put in there, but then there's a lot of bits that they didn't, so they're always sad for the ones that don't make it in.
Yeah. Well, I'm trying to remember. Do we have anything between him pulling the ship and Ramandu's island?
No. I think
boom.
That's pretty much it. They pretty much go right there. Yeah.
I want to travel the way the Don Fetter travels. This is incredible.
Lightning fast speed. Boy, Eustace must have been drinking some really good coffee or something.
Let's talk about Ramandu's Island.
Okay,
first of all, I actually have some good things to say. First of all, the overall...
Really?
Yes, I do,
okay,
actually.
You say that.
It has to do with the wonderful art direction. Not special effects necessarily, but the wonderful art direction. No, seriously. I thought the island with the huge waterfalls coming off, and I thought it was great. I really thought it looked a lot like how I imagined the island in the book. I don't know why, but somehow I kind of imagined the island in the book to have a whole lot of cliffs, like huge cliff faces going all the way around it, almost.
Yeah.
And I have to say that I thought a lot of the islands did have their own unique feel in the movie. Maybe I had, you know, complaints here and there, but in many ways, I think this is probably my favorite island. You know, Dragon Island had a
unique
feel.
They did a really good job. I just wish we could have seen more of it. We only wanted to really see two...
Like one or two shots.
We get to see the outside, and then we get to see Aslan's table and that little courtyard place where Liliana goes all fireworky. That's it, really much.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, there are... Okay, there's a... It's so hard to discuss this, because I'm trying to think... you remember, of course, that, you know, we have the whole... the crew approaching the table. They're on the island. They get up to the table. They see the banquet. And then they see something, and they're not sure what it is. It's very similar to the book in that regard.
Very slowly revealed.
Right, slowly revealed, and they get closer, and boom! I thought, kind of a genuinely creepy moment when they actually, you know, they find the guy, especially with his eyes just open.
That was something I didn't really expect them to keep that, the weirdness in, I guess. So when I saw it, I was like, oh, that's really cool.
I enjoyed that little reveal there. I thought. Because I was, okay, a huge, you know, guys with really long hair, three Rip Van Winkles, how is it going to come across? But I thought they did a really good job. It is weird, it is creepy, and it's definitely something where you see it, you think, okay, there is some magic here, and this is nothing that you ever find in our world.
Right.
Especially when you find out they're breathing.
Yeah. And props to... Like you said, set design. I love the look of Aslan's table, just like the table itself, and the way they did all the little candlesticks.
Oh, yeah.
Just all the display of food. I thought it was so cool.
No, everything about it's just the look of this scene, the lighting, the color, the cobwebs, the banquet. I loved just the look of this whole scene. I mean, it really, except for Liliandil, we can.
we'll get to that part.
We'll get there. But no, I have to give credit where credit is due. And this was one of those little moments of the movie, looking back, where my heart kind of soared a little bit. Where I felt like, as they approached the table, I thought, I feel like I'm watching the book come to life. At this one little moment, before anyone starts talking.
Yeah.
I'm going to turn this into a silent film, do my own dubbing. It's going to be so much fun.
We'll go on riff tracks.
Yes.
We'll change all the heretical things that they say into
Yeah. Well, I'm trying to I will say that when, you know, Liliandil comes in with her dialogue, I remember we were talking about the trailer at one point, and Warrior for Jesus said... she came across... What did he say? I think he said like a...
Radioactive?
Not radioactive. He was talking about the dialogue. I think he said she came across as kind of like a teenage hippie or something like that. Like, you know, like just as a teenage... Like a teenager. like a modern teenager. As opposed to a graceful lady.
Definitely... Her dialogue did not do her any favors whatsoever.
Yeah, it, I thought, okay, maybe... Because even the Lord of the Rings has some really dumb moments. It really... There are some moments I think, is this really...
Let's not mention Star Wars.
Is this really... Well, that's Star Wars. But I mean, even... That's not based on a great piece of literature. Even though Lord of the Rings has... If you look, it has some really dumb moments. You think, is this seriously in a film based on Tolkien's work? But... And I thought, okay, maybe this will just be one little weird moment. But it's like all of the dialogue was just really strange. And I felt, as a fan, it's like there were little moments where they were intentionally trying to aggravate me. It's like, you see the stone knife. Oh, that's the stone knife. Yes, that's the one that the White Witch used. Boom, now onto my next magical trick. And I think, wait, what? That's it? That seriously? You just point that out and then, well, that made the fans happy.
That's kind of like how I felt about the whole Liliandale character in general. I mean, don't get me started. As soon as I finished seeing the film, the one thing that kept coming to my mind is the thing I was most upset about is how they didn't really do anything with her at all. And her in doing the whole, Liliandale/Caspian thing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, seriously, this is the one legitimate Narnian romance, and this is all we get? I mean, Susan and Caspian got more. I'm pretty sure that if Silverchair ever gets made, 9 to 10, Jill and someone else is gonna get more than that. This is all we get. They just kind of exchange it.
As if it isn't already cursed.
And that's it. And they don't even tell anyone. They get married. Their son is Rillian of the Silver Chair. This is kind of really important.
It is important.
Rillian is very important.
Rillian is probably the most essential and important character next to Aslan in the entire
Chronicles. You're right. They have cheapened you. Don't you feel personally offended?
I am personally offended. Mom, really? Mom? No. It does several things. For one thing, it cheapens the romance, and it's all so heavy-handed. It's like, okay, it's almost like you had one scriptwriter saying, all right, now don't forget, in the book, there's a very subtle romance very subtle romance between Caspian and, well, I guess we'll call her Liliandale, that will be in the movie. And we can accomplish this with just some significant glances and some little playful banter about the, you know, prince kissing the Sleeping Beauty and all that. And that'll get a point across. And then it's like one guy said, no. There are 4-year-olds watching this film. We have to make it painfully obvious that he likes her. And, oh, yes, no, everyone loves a love triangle. Let's throw Edmund in, too. And we'll have Lucy be our voice of reason. Have her roll her eyes, please.
It wasn't even obvious. I mean, if it had been obvious, I guess it would have been something.
It's not obvious they get married. It's not obvious they get married. Because reading the book, you think...
It's obvious that she's kind of pretty, and he hasn't seen a really, really pretty woman in a long time.
Since Susan.
Since Susan. He's obviously still pining over her. If I had never read the books, I would think that Caspian was...
A player?
I was going to say committed bachelor, but... yeah.
Well, you know, there's so much significance that when, you know, why did they... okay, you can try to remind me, what was it she said that caused the men to fall asleep? Because doesn't she say, is this because violence is forbidden?
I think so.
Because in the book, one of them picks up the stone knife, which is not for them to touch. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, I think, no, you're right. I'm trying to remember if they had anything about, they connected the stone knife to them falling asleep, and I can't remember.
In the movie, they don't. There is nothing there's nothing there. It's just, it's very, it's weird. It's kind of like, well, it's kind of a message of, well, they shouldn't fight. But it's like, well, look at all the fighting we've been doing in this movie.
And we're going to send them off to another fight.
Yes, yes, please.
Yay.
Go fight
go
again.
Pacifists.
And also, this is the part of the film where, I mean, the book, where they really understand, okay, this, going it to the world's end, this is not just Reap's destiny, it is all of their destinies, and it is Reap's destiny. I mean, it's not, it's kind of just stated, kind of implied that Reepichi will be left behind. That is his heart's desire. He will be left behind, and then they will come back. And so, it's again, all, it's all about the, finding the seven swords. You know, again, it's like, remember how at Deathwater, or whatever they called it, it's like, oh, the poor man, oh, get his sword! And here, they're pretty quickly, oh, look around there, they must have their swords here. And then, you know, they find their swords. It's all practical, it's all useful. It loses so much of the grace and the glory.
Right.
It's all about the smoke.
Yeah.
It really is.
Pretty much. And I mean, I said it before, the smoke I could have handled somewhat. But the swords, I mean, there's just no excuse for that whatsoever. So yeah.
It's not even the smoke, it's what it distracts you from. Because the attention, and then, you know, this was my, okay, it's the same principle, but it's magnified here. My complaint, when we first thought that Trumpkin would be in Voyage of the Dawn Treader, my complaint was not that, you know, oh, we shouldn't have Trumpkin there. I thought it made more sense for him to be back home, but I said, okay, if he's there, they will necessarily have to build up character development around him, spend a lot of screen time
right.
with him.
I remember that and being mentioned.
That was my main concern, is it throwing off or detracting from the great relationships that are already present in the book that they will have plenty to deal with if they really work with.
Right.
You know,
yeah.
You have Caspian and Edmund. You have Edmund and Eustace. Eustace and Reepicheep. You have all those little intricate relationships going on. But I thought, well, if, you know, Trumpkin's there, I'm not necessarily, that's not necessarily going to be a terrible thing, but what if it distracts from those relationships? That's really what the Green Mist did. Yes, I wouldn't like it anyway, but the real harm in it, I think, is it distracts from the real purpose of the voyage. And it's
yeah.
like, I mean, as far, it's just the title, The Voyage of the Dawn Treader, it's like, it's not even the same voyage. They're not even trying to do the same thing.
It's not the quest of the Dawn Treader.
Right.
Or the quest to save Narnia, or
yeah.
Dawn Treader defeats the Green Smoke.
I'm surprised they
Black Smoke.
I'm surprised they still call it Dark Island.
It's really green.
Yeah, I really am kind of, well, not even just Green Island, it's like, it's almost like they don't even imply it's an island at all. I mean, it's
more like a figment of the Green Smoke, just kind of like a big cloud.
See, watching this, I want to see another similar idea that was executed so much better. The never-ending story had the nothing. Ooh, it was so much cooler in the never-ending story.
Yeah, I haven't seen that, so I can't comment.
Okay. Well, yeah, I mean, this is all kind of, I think this whole portion of the movie, a lot of what they're trying to do, this is really a good example of, I think a lot of things they try to do, they don't understand the real ramifications and consequences, and maybe they had some good end intentions, but what happened, it's kind of like the changes to Peter's character in Prince Caspian. It's like, okay, the basic idea of what they wanted to do was not bad. Okay, teach Peter humility, but the way that they did it destroyed so much, and there was so much other baggage that carried him along with it that this whole part of the film, I'm not really happy with any of the changes that were made. There were some things that I liked. I really liked that, those few seconds when they arrive at the Mandu's Island, and then before Leandel starts talking. And I didn't even mind her glowing so much. A lot of people hated it. I thought it was kind of weird, but there were some parts where I didn't...
It wasn't really distracting. I thought it might be distracting, but it wasn't. So
I wish that they had been a little more subtle. I don't think it's in the vocabulary of some of these filmmakers, but I mean, if they had done it like Galadriel in Fellowship of the Ring, you know how they did all kinds of things. They had her glowing.
She was a little glowy, but
yeah. Well, they even had stars in her eyes. Glowing. If you look in Galadriel's eyes, they intentionally put stars in her eyes, and even something like that would have been cool. Oh, subtlety, people.
Unfortunately, we don't have our version of a Peter Jackson, which is probably the saddest thing that's ever happened to Narnia.
Yeah.
We need to get someone like him, who's really passionate about the books. That way,
I think Andrew Adamson was the closest thing we of all the people.
He was
passionate.
He got bashed a lot, but
he was passionate.
I think
there were some significant things he didn't understand. But I think he was definitely passionate, and that's...
He definitely cared about what he was
doing.
It
showed.
Andrew Anderson, if you're listening to this, please come back and do the Magician's Nephew.
I remember when I was talking to... I was talking to Glumfuddle, and it was right before the film. Oh, no, it was maybe a month before the film, and I said, I'm ready to say it. It was November, I think, and I said, I'm ready to say it. I miss Andrew Adamson. And then Glumfuddle said... Oh no, I'm not ready to say that yet. No, I think I'm still holding out hope. I still think it could be better than the first two. I think it's still possible. And then the next day after the film, I texted him, "I miss Andrew Adamson," and he just said, "Yep."
I think he gets a bad rap that he probably doesn't deserve. So.
Well.
Yeah, I told you this. I think I've been been rewatching Prince Caspian and just kind of rediscovering how much I loved it.
Mm-hmm.
It's definitely improved with time. Definitely, Prince Caspian is definitely my favorite Narnia film by far. And
I like it. It's my favorite of the
two. Not much about it I don't like now. There's not really a lot. So yeah, it's really good.
It's also not only that, but the more I've read the books, the more I'm able to appreciate it. There's some things I dislike about it more as I've... Because there's some themes I've realized, oh, they completely lost this one theme or something like that. But that's another discussion. But anyway, no, we'll have more wrap-up at the end of this discussion and talk about just what we think of all three films. And it would be
Aren't we almost there?
Well, we're over halfway through the film. We're approaching the climax.
Oh, yeah. Oh,
we're approaching
the
climax.
At the end of this discussion.
No.
Particular discussion.
Sorry.
I thought that's what we were doing.
No. It'd be neat to really compare at the end of the podcast. Not the podcast, the analysis, and talk about, okay, each film, you know, what do we think of them? So, all right. Well, we got a little ways through the film. Got through another island, which is good.
One and a half. One and a mainland to go.
A mainland. And a really good looking wave.
An amazing wave. And that's, I think I said this, the wave had the best 3D effect in the whole movie.
Yeah, you said that.
Going through the wave.
Mm-hmm.
That was really cool. That was the best 3D I've ever seen in a film. The rest of the movie was meh. I mean, I could have done without the 3D, but that was really cool.
All right. Well, I'll keep that in mind if I find one with 3D glasses.
Yeah, I know. All right.
Thank you very much, Jim Fan.
You're welcome.